Introductions. Okay.
So I'm Lenny.
Okay.
And this is Benny.
I'm Benny.
And we're both experts
in science fiction. That's not true at all.
It's not, but that's the best part.
Okay, yeah. Maybe you're an expert.
Well, I guess I teach this a lot, so I've got like a little
niche. You probably are an expert.
Carved into it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a little hole dug into one corner of the giant field of science fiction.
Right. Which corner did you dig your hole into?
The most interesting corner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're going to talk about this essay by Samuel Delaney.
Who's this for, though? Is this for your students?
This right here?
What we're doing.
This is for anybody that loves science fiction.
Oh, okay.
Or just loves hearing us talk about science fiction.
But who's that going to be?
You're going to get a mix of Leonard and Benny and sci-fi. It's like a parfait. You know how the peanuts are on top and then the chocolate and you get the...
I've never had a parfait like that.
Shut up. You have to. You know, where you read a story and you get your feedback and then you get your emotions. It's like that. The reader response.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about
that
earlier.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I consider myself an expert in my own response.
You didn't even know that that was a form of criticism until I told you.
No, that's right.
Okay, so you found this book.
Yes, Silent Interviews by Samuel R. Delaney.
And it's a bunch of interviews with him trying to figure out like what science fiction is.
Well, the first one is that. I'm not sure, but I haven't gotten past the first one.
So we've only dug a tiny hole in this book itself.
Yeah, this is a recording of tiny holes.
We dug it really well, though.
Did we?
It was, you know, like a grave, 6 feet deep, and the sides were really...
Yeah.
I'm good with a shovel.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can tell.
Yeah. So I guess my first question... Well, before we get to questions.
Okay.
Let's back up. Mm-hmm. You want to give like a gist of what he talks about in this essay for people that haven't read it and they're like, I don't want to read it, just tell me.
Okay. Well, the parts that I was paying attention to... What? Why is that funny? I mean, he has kind of... So he's being interviewed. It's a silent interview because it's a written interview, I guess. It's like a correspondence interview. That's why it's called Silent Interviews.
Really?
The whole book is correspondence interviews.
Oh, I guess I missed that part. I thought it was just the metaphor for that concert that happens at the end of it.
Oh, no. I don't even know if I got there. What concert that happens at the end? At the end of this interview, there's a concert?
We'll get to it.
Okay.
So, it's interviews.
The reason the book
apparently
is called
Silent
Interviews, because he has other books that are different interviews.
Got it.
Not silent. These are silent because they happen offline.
Okay.
I don't know. Some of them maybe happened online at first, and then he wrote elaborated responses.
Because a lot of it does seem very complex.
Yeah.
And not something that
you just
would
be chatting about. Yeah.
Right. I was like, if he just said this in an interview, the man is much smarter than I thought. I mean, he's already a genius, but I was like, damn.
Yeah.
He's using some complex language.
I think he is... I've heard he's very smart, and
I have no
he
doubt.
He certainly seems like.
But there's parts of it where I was like, "Whoa!" I had to go back and reread through it, just to get what he was going. And there's also parts where he's using like textual language that you can't really do in an interview. So he's talking about how you can take out all the vowels, and it still is readable in English.
That's right.
And
that's
it's
right.
Like, I don't think he was pronouncing like you can droop the wheels in English. You know.
Right. There's parts of this that you have to read.
Right.
You can't just hear them.
So
in this silent interview, his interviewers, two interviewers, Cinda Gregory and Larry McCaffrey, both of San Diego State University. And it did begin as a recorded conversation. It says, they're asking him about what he thinks differentiates science fiction from literature or other kinds of literature. Because they know that he has opinions about this.
Because he's been labeled as a science fiction writer. Sort of
yeah.
His whole career.
Right.
And he talks about at one point, he had written 5 novels... They were all like literary novels and he tried to get them published and they're like, well, the problem is he used this metaphor of the like housewife from Kansas and the like high school English professor from Montana. Neither of them are interested in the sort of subgenre, like outside of, you know, straight white culture that you're writing about, they don't want to read that in a literary novel. But if you put it into sci-fi, they'll totally be down.
Hmm.
So because of his experiences as like a gay black man and sort of, you know, being without a support system, he gravitated to science fiction, I guess. That's sort of the gist.
Where did you get that from?
He talks about it in the second part where he's talking about Dahlgren a little bit. And he he's saying the reason people liked Dahlgren was because they'd experienced it.
Really liked that part.
They'd been homeless, they'd been in mental institutions, they had been abandoned by their family for whatever reasons, right? They'd been let down by all sorts of supports. And when they read it, they were like, I don't give a shit that it's written in very complex language. I don't care that, you know, it's not really a clear plot of what's going on. I relate to it.
Yeah.
And other people that have like fought to keep all those support services, family, friends, status together, they were like, I hate this book because it's like terrifying. It like touched a nerve. So that was kind of, he was like, yes, it's science fiction, and yes, I've been put into this genre for like various reasons.
Right.
So the big question is, do you agree with his definition, or are there parts you
of what science fiction is?
Yeah, because he gives an interesting definition that may take us a while to figure out.
The one about objectivity versus subjectivity?
Yeah, but before we get into that, I guess, did you agree with his definition or
not? I'm trying to understand what his definition was. Is that what it was?
So, I gathered... Well, okay, let me backtrack.
Okay.
Let me back up a little bit. My definition for science fiction, I ripped off from Kingsley Ames, who is a noted British literary critic and author. And he wrote this book of criticism called New Maps of Hell. And in it, he gives this definition of science fiction that I use in my classes. So he says, science fiction is that class of prose narrative treating of a situation that could not arise in the world we know, but which is hypothesized on the basis of some new innovation in science or technology, or pseudoscience and technology. So it's really like a question. Like if you ask the question, well, what if we could travel through time? Or like, what if we could go to another planet? Or what if we could artificially make humans? And then you explore that.
So this seems like, sometimes I've heard recently the term speculative fiction. It sounds like this definition is about the speculating part. It's like a what if.
Yeah, so that's why they all are sort of in this, they're all in this wider genre of fantasy of something that's not this world, right? But they're like subgenres of it. But Delaney takes offense, or he disagrees with this. There's an awesome part in the essay, if I can find it, where the interviewer is like, so what you're saying is it's all about how you read science fiction. He's like, that's not what I'm saying at all. That's absolutely incorrect. And I was like, that's awesome. But anyway, he says that science fiction doesn't start before 1926.
Yeah.
And anything before that is not science fiction. And when I first read that, I was like, the fuck? That seems counterintuitive to me, because I thought of like H.G. Wells, I thought of The Time Machine and The War of the Worlds, and I thought of...
Are those before that?
Yeah, The War of the Worlds was written in like 1893, and The Time Machine was like 1895.
Oh.
So it's like 30 years before that. And he says like, okay, 20, 30 years at the outside.
Yeah.
But I gathered over the course of the essay that he is making this differentiation based on the idea that people before 1926 are asking this question, but they're not assuming the question. So, for example, he talks about Frankenstein is often quoted as the first sci-fi story. And he disagrees.
That was 1818.
Right. And he disagrees, I think, because, he doesn't say this exactly, because the story is like, it asks the question, it doesn't assume the question. So it asks, okay, what if a scientist reanimated a corpse? What do we do then? Well, here's the story. The corpse would get pissed because the scientist didn't respect it, and they would kill his family, and then they would die, and then that's the end of the story. Science fiction, after 1926, build stories like Blade Runner, which is, you know, do androids dream of electric sheep, where, what about a world where that's the case? What about a world where it's the first page you go in and you're like, yeah, there's artificial humans everywhere. That's the switch. So like the example with the time machine, you have this Victorian inventor, he makes a time machine, he goes to the future, he finds out the humans have de-evolved into two different species, and that's the end of the story. It's different from a science fiction story where, like, the first page, it's taken for granted that time travel is like a new technology. I was thinking of that when I read this book by Larry Nevin called Rainbow Mars, where, like, the first sentence is about this explorer who's captured a unicorn, which in the book is like a species that's gone extinct, but he's gone far enough back in time to get it. And he, like, it almost kills him in his, like, time machine. I was like, that's that's different, right? It's like assuming. So
wait, so the distinction is whether it takes for granted the ability to speculate in this way or something?
It's how you answer the question, basically. It's like, if you just ask the question, that's not science fiction. It's like a proto-science fiction. If you assume all of the implications of the question, like you start at A and you go all the way to Z, that's science fiction. So check this out. On page 33, he says, he has this quotation, "The monopole magnet mining operations in the outer asteroid belt of Delta Cygni," which he says is a quote from some Larry novel, Larry Nevin story that he can't remember. And he says, what separates this sentence is that it says the object, the location, the methodology, and the spatial organization of minds will change. And it says that far more strongly than, and well before it says anything about, say, the inner chthonic profundities of any fictive character in those minds or about the psychology of the writer writing about them, which is where immediately the expectation of the literary-oriented critic are likely to lead him or her in constructing any interpretation.
So it's saying, it's about, this is like the object-subject distinction, where he's saying, like, this is way more about those objects, the object, the location, the methodology, than it is about the people living in that time.
So he answers both questions, to me, with that quote, where he says science fiction is based on taking the question and the answer for granted to, like, its farthest extent. And this is also what separates it from literary fiction.
I thought it was interesting that that he was saying, like, literary fiction is about the psychology of the
It's all about the inside.
Characters, But I can kind of see why the interviewer was, like, saying, oh, it's about this mindset that you have when reading it. Because he gives the example of, like, you can hit this sentence about the monopoles, and you can read it wondering about why the narrator is saying this about monopoles.
Yeah.
Or you can be like, what does this mean about the world where the narrator lives?
Right.
So in that sense, the mindset thing does seem, it does seem like you could approach the same text in different ways.
I guess that was a part that I disagreed with, because I thought, yeah, you're right that the sentence structure of sci-fi does operate on this level of, like, answering the question completely. But I was like, that's built on stuff. The reason that, like, Frankenstein and the Time Machine don't go that far is because they just figured this out. They're like, we can ask a crazy question and let's answer it. Like, if H.G. Wells would have lived long enough and had different, you know, experiences, he might have been like, oh, well, the time traveler could do a bunch of time travel stuff. Like, what would this do to commerce? How could this solve the problems of capitalism? Like, he just didn't, you know, they're the first ones to figure it out. So it's like, it takes time to build on this. So it was hard for me to buy that this isn't something that the reader brings to it. I think this is like, whether it's like accumulated knowledge of civilization or it's like accumulated, like, reader knowledge, it's hard to not understand that without that, like, background. So it seemed like, to me, that was something he overlooked, but you know, maybe he just,
I feel like his argument. I'm wondering, his point was probably just, like, subtle or something. Well, I guess I'm thinking like it's unlikely that he overlooked something.
That's possible.
But also, I remember reading this and being like, well, that's a subtle distinction. He says, I don't think you can properly call the ability to read and understand any of these science fiction phrases, sentences, or conventions a matter of mindset any more than you could call the ability to read French, Urdu, or Elizabethan English poetry a matter of mindset. So I guess, I think his problem is that mindset is maybe a little too, a mindset would be too easy to slip into. It's more like you need to actually understand the language, which is not just a mindset. I think that's what the issue he was taking. He's like, this is a different sort of like symbolical language than these other things. That, it's not just like you needed to drink coffee before you read it or something.
Right. Yeah. Because he talks about the differences between like poetry and fiction, or, you know, fiction and screenwriting and
right.
You know, script writing, and he's like, they're not, they have much more in common than they do separation. So it's harder to distinguish the two. It also made me think of like, well, even though those are all different languages, you still have some kind of construct in your head to understand language. Like, there's still some kind of base there to build upon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like if you hear someone speaking Urdu or French,
right.
You can be like, yeah, they're speaking Urdu. No, I don't know what they're saying.
Right.
But like, I get it.
Yeah.
You know?
And or like sort of below that, you know, oh, they're speaking a language. Like they're not. Yeah, just...
they're not just making nonsensical sounds.
Yeah.
I thought he kind of swept that under the rug a little bit. I guess the other part was when he mentions Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka, and he talks about how every reader has this mindset of, you know, the first line is about. He turns into a giant beetle, and you're like, oh, what does this say about, like, oppressive Austrian society at the turn of the century, and, like, what does this say about his father and all this stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember thinking the first time I read the story in college, I read it as, like, a sci-fi reader. Yeah. I was like, oh, he's a beetle.
Yeah.
Well, is he going to have to, like, lay his eggs and something? Mm-hmm. Like, where is this going to go
next?
Yeah, like,
he should
probably
totally.
Find some other beetles. Or,
yeah.
Or, like, and then he talked about that later, where he was like, if you put this in a sci-fi story... it would all be about figuring out how far this change goes.
Mm-hmm.
If you read this in a sci-fi story, you'd be like, well, what evil genius turned him into a beetle? What technology do they do? Or like, you know, fitting the world to what you found in that first sentence.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, it is kind of a matter of mindset a little bit, because I assume Kafka was being literal because I hadn't been trained in like literary genre reading well enough. And I remember going to class and they're all talking about his like mental state. And I was like, I thought he was a beetle though.
Yeah.
What are all these metaphors of oppression? What are you talking about?
Yeah. I found that very sort of liberating to read too, because I feel like most of high school or most of like my education about writing, I was always like, definitely not into motifs, not into like metaphor or.
Oh, they're so good.
Because I was reading like that.
They're like.
I was reading like, let's just like talk about what's happening, like in the thing that we're reading. Like, why are we jumping to all these conclusions about this being a metaphor for that? Like, there's so much to talk about, just like, what is happening in the story. So I do think I liked reading this because. I like, it's like kind of like an authority figure validating my response to English education. Yeah.
It makes sense though, because it's criticism coming from an author and a creator.
Yeah.
So this is a very common response for people that have either like done criticism and been like, I don't want to be a critic. Because the old joke is that, you know, like literature professors and critics are just failed artists.
Mm-hmm.
And part of their like bitterness and critiques is because they couldn't do it themselves. They can't actually write a novel, so they're going to write about your novel. Yeah. So it makes sense. I also thought it was interesting that, you know, he has this whole introduction about the sentence. Mm-hmm. And how the sentence is like the basic structure of language, not the word.
Yeah.
Which I was like, I don't buy this, but I do buy this. Yeah, like, you do a really good job of justifying. Like, you sold me, but like only until I stop reading.
Right.
This.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
You know. But
yeah, it's like all the poets I know are not going to be happy about
that. Well, he said there's like he's like a sentence can like condemn you to death, and I was like, yeah, but it could be a single word sentence. You could just be like, die.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, but that would count as a sentence.
I know.
His point would be that it's the sentenceness.
Right, there's the exclamation point, you know, it's in quotations. I get it. But I thought it was really fascinating that he took his, like, love for the sentence and his life with the sentence as a writer
mm-hmm.
and then used it to build this definition from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. So, like, Kingsley Ames' definition is from the top up, right, where he was like, any change to the universe, right? Any kind of pseudoscience, regular science that could possibly happen, that's science fiction. Mm-hmm. He starts from like the top up and then fits all this stuff in it.
Mm.
And Delaney says, you can start at the bottom up. You can start with any single sentence from a science fiction book and it expands backwards into this definition. So he says, any sentence from a story that has faster than light travel. He's saying it tells you in the single sentence that, you know, Einsteinian physics has all been demolished.
Right.
That all the things you could imagine we could do with fast and light travel, we did it. It's already done.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like it's implied in that single sentence, this entire history of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And to him, that's what sci-fi is the answer to the question to like its fullest extent.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was really fascinating, that sort of bottom-up approach to definition.
Hmm.
I wanted to put it to the test of, like, collecting all of these different sentences from sci-fi, but I don't think you even have to do it that far. I think it happens all the time.
So what would the test look like?
Like, just pull a sentence out of a piece of science fiction, just and randomly see any book, and see what is implied in it.
Uh-huh.
And I just open a page, pull a sentence out. I don't know. I was thinking of like Dune, and I was like, you could open any page of it.
Yeah.
They could be talking about like spice harvesters or, you know.
Yeah.
The emperor or like whatever. And it all implies like, well, they have intergalactic travel and they have this, you know, chemical called a spice that causes longevity, whatever. Like it backpedals, it sort of forms all of this world. Are you going to pull out some sci-fi?
Yeah, I thought that was a good idea.
I think I left my Robert Silverberg in the other room. So.
Oh, yeah? You could get it. Here are three. Four, maybe.
Give me two and...
Okay, what's up? You get Octavia Butler and Samuel Delaney himself.
Okay.
I get Alfred Bester and Gene Wolfe. I haven't actually read this one, so I don't know if it counts, but...
Well, I think it probably...
We have to do it at random, though, right?
Yeah.
So I'll give you a number.
Okay.
What's my bounds on my number?
327.
Okay, go to 252.
Okay.
Middle of the page.
252.
This is Parable of the Sower.
Mm-hmm.
Are you cheating?
Well, so, okay, I don't know what the diameters are, because there's, like, simple sentences in here
read one. So, what was one in the middle?
One in the middle. I saw movement over near the burned-out carcass of the truck.
Okay. That implies a few things, right? Like, so, you got a bad truck. it's a demolished truck. So, you're in a world where a truck can be demolished. That's not too dissimilar from this world, but, you know... It has some of the post-apocalyptic tone of the... This is also kind of a different kind of...
It is science fiction, but it's not as science fiction-y as her other books. Mm. Some of them, you know, it's like the whole book you're talking to aliens.
Mm.
So then it would sort of be implied.
Uh-huh.
If you were reading Lilith's Brood or something. Mm-hmm. Any page, they have all these aliens in them doing whatever.
Yeah.
So this is harder. Okay, well, let's try Delaney himself... Okay. In Babel 17,
okay.
And see what we can do. So maybe Parable of the Sower is more
It's definitely science fiction.
It's science fiction.
I think it just has to do with the time period it was written. Like, it's written near present, and what's different is, like capitalism is, like, totally nuts.
Also that the main character feels other people's pain. So there's certain pages where it's, like, implicit that there's this alteration in her. Yeah. And other pages there's not.
Right.
So, okay, Delaney won down, I don't know, didn't win with that page, but let's try himself. You want to give me a page number?
It's 58.
You want to give me a section?
First sentence on the page.
First sentence.
Careful.
Okay. You remember what the politics were like then between Pan-Africa and Americasia.
Wow.
I was sure she didn't speak English.
That works pretty well. I mean, you got a Pan-Africa.
Right.
And America. Asia.
So we have this implication that Africa has been united into some sort of total political format, and America has been united with Asia in some sort of way, and this has devalued the properties of English. So, like, a massive world change.
Right.
All in one sentence. We can backtrack. It's like, think of how much is involved in that. Like, Africa uniting, or even being, like, operating on a higher level than the various, you know, intergovernmental agencies that operate in Africa now.
Yeah.
There's a lot.
Yeah.
So.
But, right.
He did it.
Yeah.
So, okay, there's 1-1.
Okay.
What do you got?
Well, one thing, though, is that it is a little ridiculous. Like, definitely science fiction does this, but I would hope it doesn't do it with every sentence in a book, because that would get pretty exhausting, probably. So this test we're doing is a little...
I don't think it would get exhausted, because... So he says at a certain point in the essay, I gotta find the quote, where this guy is like, science fiction works unless it changes what is known. So there's a known, what's known to the reader, and if you change it too much, it becomes like science fantasy. So
he's talking about Star Wars, I think.
Yeah, where he's like, if you set up certain ideas and then just break them, it doesn't work anymore. It becomes something else. So you have to stick with what's in the story. So, like, if you're reading Babel 17, you get the idea it's an intergalactic war, they have this new weapon, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
There's not that much else to figure out. If you're reading Dune, you're like, okay, intergalactic empire, you know, the spies, all that stuff.
Yeah.
It just sits in the back of your head. Like, you don't have to refigure it out every sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like you know everything
mm-hmm.
in the first sentence. And then you just get the little details filled out.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think it's that exhausting.
Even if it's every sentence. Because you have all this context.
I think that this may differentiate why some people like science fiction and why some people
mm-hmm.
don't.
Mm-hmm.
Is this, like, world exploration. Where mm-hmm. the world is shifted in some way. And there's all these implications. And then the author's like, I'm going to explore all of these. We're going to see what would happen if people live forever. We could travel through time.
Yeah.
And there's so many details. And some people are just like, I can't.
Yeah.
Dude, I'm not into this whole world creation thing. And there's also subgenres of that. I mean, Delaney himself is an example where, you know, if you're writing for, like, a very uptight, like, straight, heteronormative audience, they're going to be like, I don't want to read about these people. He has a quotation about Dahlgren where editors are like, I don't want to know these people exist. I don't want to associate with them. I mean, it's very fucked up, but he says that's part of why he's sort of like a niche author, is because you're writing for certain people.
Mm.
So I think it's both of those. So there's like niches inside it. So. You want to continue the test?
Yeah, let's keep doing the test.
Okay.
So you get, like, 250 pages.
What book is that?
This is The Demolished Man, Alfred Bester.
Oh, okay. So
you
the
didn't
classic.
Like this one.
Yeah.
Okay.
I haven't read it. I've just read Stars, My Destination.
Oh.
So I haven't read it. I read it, his other one of his
classics. Oh, interesting. Okay. I wonder if I've read this.
It doesn't matter for this test.
It does not. Okay.
Yeah.
What's the page?
So the page is 250. We're going to go near the end.
250? That is the end. I might have even rounded. No, that's the page.
Okay. Top third of the page.
Okay. I mean, I'm cheating here.
Stay within that paragraph. You got to pick one from that
okay.
top third paragraph.
Okay, I'll do this long quote. Listen, he cried in exultation. Listen, normals. You must learn what it is. You must learn how it is. Oh, it's just a sentence, right? I don't know why I'm doing the whole quote.
But that's okay. All you need was listen, normals.
Yeah, right.
There's
some
kind of implication that he has some special power that other people don't. There's some kind of reveal that's going to change the world.
Right.
He's telling us about, you know, I just discovered this new amazing thing and it's going to alter your world.
Right.
So that, we don't know what it is yet, but it's sort of like he's announcing that he can read minds or travel through time or whatever, and you better get ready.
Okay.
So that's, Delaney's doing pretty good so far.
Okay. Okay, this is Shadow and Claw by Gene Wolfe.
Okay.
I don't even know if it really counts as science fiction or fantasy, because I haven't read it.
Yeah, Gene Wolfe does write both, so I don't know.
Okay, 400 pages here.
Well, let's do like 120.
Okay.
Do the bottom paragraph.
I understand, I said. Suddenly, laughter overcame me. What fools we must have looked, jolting along in the... Fiacre? Is that a word? Fiacre?
I have to look at it.
F-I-A-C-R-E.
I don't think so. I think it may be science fiction.
The next line is, if you understand, then kiss me.
this podcast is getting pretty steamy. So, there's an implication there that...
Well, we either don't know what a fiacre is.
Or our vocab's not good enough.
Yeah.
No, I don't. Jolting along in the fiacre. Yeah, so obviously there's some sort of differentiation. So that like half counts. This is almost a tie.
Okay.
Yeah, but again, we don't know if that book's science fiction. So I guess we'll give Delaney this one. We probably should. He's much smarter and more talented and more famous than us. We probably shouldn't talk too much shit.
No.
He might call us up. He's still alive.
You know? That would be cool.
Probably more cool than we could handle. If he's listening in.
I don't think he is.
Hopefully he'll send us a signed copy.
I think he'd probably be like, what are these two white guys doing talking about?
I don't know if he would necessarily, you know, go that direction, but it's possible. Okay. Hopefully he would just be like, what are these two idiots doing discussing my work in such a manner? Okay. Should we keep talking about Delaney? Did we answer the question?
Of whether we like his definition? Of science fiction?
Do you agree with it? Does it work for you?
Yeah.
I think it works.
Sure.
It works for me. I would just clarify the idea of proto-science fiction.
Uh-huh.
So I would be like, well, is this still science fiction? It's just there's actually two eras of sci-fi.
Oh, okay.
It's not all the same. You can't compare Frankenstein,
mm-hmm.
you know, to Bester, you know, all the pulp stuff in the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that there's a shift that occurs by 1926,
mm-hmm.
Which may be explainable at the sentence level. So that's the caveat that I would put in there. But yeah, I agree with him. It was really fun read.
Yeah.
Because I was like, it's all mindset. You know it's mindset. Shut up. You know it's mindset. And I was like, oh, wait, it's not. I get it. So
this definitely would apply to the story that you sent to me. The, what's it called? A Day for the Sun? Morning? A Special Kind of Morning.
A Special Kind of Morning.
I mean, that is just loaded with...
Probably even the first sentence. Well, okay, the second sentence. So, A Special Kind of Morning by Gardner Dozois, who passed away recently, so I started reading his work. I don't know if we talked about that.
Yeah,
he died a couple of months ago. He's a very famous editor. He edited all sorts of collections. He didn't write as much as he did editing. That's where he put most of his energy.
Hmm.
And I hadn't read any of his work, and then I read his eulogy, forget which famous author gave his eulogy, but you know, I was bummed out. I'd heard of him and I was like, oh man. And I read his eulogy and it mentioned this story.
Mm.
And I think it had mentioned that it was a war story, which I'm always fascinated with.
Yeah.
And so I looked it up and I was like, oh wow. So the first two sentences, it starts with, did you ever hear the one about the old man in the sea? Halt a minute, lordling, stop and listen. So from the second sentence, the use of lordling, we get the idea that, well, this isn't in like the U.S.
Yeah.
You know, people don't stop us with lordling.
Yeah.
So we've got to be somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it doesn't get into real sci-fi, probably. So in the middle of the second paragraph, he says, as for futility, everyone dies the true death eventually, even though executives may dodge it for a few hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
The hole gets them all in the end, and I imagine that's futility enough for a start.
Mm-hmm.
So from there, you get this entire back formation of they've got some kind of death preventative technology.
All right.
They can store memories. They can have longevity, whatever.
Yeah.
So...
I don't know if all that comes across. When I read that, I was just like, oh, they can live for a while.
Yeah, I guess I'm reading into it because we've read the story.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So I'm getting more out of it.
Yeah.
But it works.
Mm-hmm.
So
I had a question for you about this. So the story starts with... the narrator is addressing a person who he's talking to, a young guy, young person. I don't know if...
Young man, yeah.
Yeah. And... it's not clear, like, how they started talking, exactly. It seems like the narrator was just sort of sitting somewhere on the street, and this guy wandered over, and but he ends up paying him to tell him a story, I think.
Right.
And he's kind of, like, chiding him for being young and stupid, and...
Yeah.
So, my question for you was, do you wish that you were the person sitting on the pavement in front of the narrator being told this story?
Wait, do I wish I was the young man or the narrator?
The young man.
I don't want to be either of them.
Okay.
I think this story is fantastic because it's so dystopian.
Mm.
I wouldn't want to be in either place. That's what I love about it the most, is that it doesn't pull any punches.
Mm.
A lot of times, dystopian stories these days, if they're like Hollywood, they end happily. Which ruins a good dystopia, because the whole point is that the world remains intact and terrible, so that we're like, oh, we should prevent this from happening.
Right.
This is so far in the future that it's kind of hard to like be like, we got to stop building this intergalactic empire, but...
Right.
So, no, I don't want to be either of them. Okay. I guess if I had a choice, I'd rather be the young guy, because he's younger and he has legs.
Oh, right.
And he's not a full-blown alcoholic, and he's not haunted by all these... terrible war memories, but still, it doesn't sound that cool. So the story is about this, like, war that happens between these two groups of humans.
Yeah.
One is this former, like, galactic federation called the Combine, and then the other is these rebels called the Quaestors.
Why is the Combine... I feel like that shows up in a lot of science fiction. What's up with that?
I think it just conjures nice dystopian images for a couple reasons. One is we think of like a combine for like thrashing wheat.
Right.
And you're always like, you think of the trope from like horror movies of like falling in the combine, right? And getting like cut into pieces.
Mm.
And then there's also the verb of... form of the word to bring everyone together.
Yeah.
So it has like both of these negative connotations, like we're gonna cut you into pieces and then combine you with other pieces.
Huh.
I don't know. Maybe there was some story that used that term early on.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right, it shows up in Half-Life 2. I don't know if you ever played that video.
Oh, yeah.
The alien overlords are called the Combine.
Oh.
Probably in a bunch of other science fiction that I haven't read.
Huh.
But I think it's just a handy... because probably no empire, no matter how evil, would call themselves that. You know, nobody would be like, let's call ourselves the Combine. It's got a catchy ring to it. I'm sure the PR folks won't have any problem with that. You know, they would have something like uplifting.
Yeah, right.
You know, Rome had like uplifting names for itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Confederate States of America doesn't sound horrible. It's just like, well, they're united. They're confederated. It's fine, you know. So But it works for the story, right?
Yeah.
Like, we don't really know if it was called that. Maybe this is just what the rebels called it. Maybe it had, like, a particular name where it was, like, the Federation of United Planets
mm-hmm.
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just their name for it. You know, yeah. It's like every state has its own, like, you know, Russia has some, you know,
right
name, but we just say Russia.
Right. Probably most evil forces are trying to go under the radar a little bit. They want to seem really boring, like.
Right. Yeah, it's usually like an acronym or something, or just the Republic of something, right?
The Republican Party.
Yeah, trying to go under the radar with their evil. It's also a short story, so there's not that much time to, like, you know, I love acronyms in science fiction. Mm. I do that all the time, especially writing, like, military sci-fi. Mm. The military loves acronyms, and so they go together. But he's only got, like, 20 pages, so there's not a lot of time to be, like, talking about the origin of the Combine and how they're named.
Mm-hmm.
So, did you have other questions for me? That's the gist of the story. Is it's about this guy who goes through a war against this sort of evil intergalactic empire. Yeah. And they,
I guess
they
I was
win.
Really curious about the form. Whether the form of it was that? Well, okay, so because, like, it doesn't actually get in. I know that you love the world that it builds, but it doesn't really get into that until you're several pages in already. So I guess I was kind of wondering how you were feeling at the very beginning of the story compared to, I feel like the meat of it is once he gets into describing the battle and the world, but it takes him a little while of just, like, sort of joking with this guy.
I thought it was lame, personally.
Okay.
It, like, the first time I read it, I gave up because I was like, this is supposed to be great, but I don't know what is going on here. Like, get to the point, old man. You have your booze, you peed yourself, let's get on with the story. So, you know, again, we're just talking shit about people that wrote better stuff than us. But still, I did find that I was like, what editor was like, you know, you could just cut to the chase, get to that battle during the realignment that you, you know, mentioned.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know.
Okay.
Now I'm like, I don't really care. It's a great story. I get it. Yeah. I mean, it sort of segues, right? Because he answers this question at the end of, like, you'll appreciate mornings. Like, you're not appreciating the morning now because you haven't been through this shit, but you will.
Mm-hmm.
If you see a planet destroyed, if you go through an intergalactic war, if you lose your, you know, father figure in a battle, if you discover that all humans are human, then you'll appreciate the morning. So it sets up the ending, but so maybe that's why he had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe Dozois was like, I can't, there's not, like, a nice moral point that I can interject.
Mm.
I've had this issue in stories of trying to put a frame narrative in because it makes it more poignant.
Mm.
Because there's a gap of time, right? This is the old man talking about his younger self.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's probably narrative reasons, but yeah, initially I was like, I could do without this this ramble.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. What did you like about the story? Were there parts of it that you were confused by, or you were like, this isn't working for me?
I guess when I was first reading it, I was thinking, I guess, like, the character of the narrator seemed kind of cliche or something. Like the sort of, like, old beggar telling his old tales. I was like, I've seen that in a Disney movie, probably.
But his actual identity is not a cliche. It's pretty unique, actually.
His identity is,
well, he's the son. Okay, so they're in this universe where the Combine uses humans as, like, processing power.
Yeah.
They have all these people that don't have, they're, like, grown in vats. It's sort of like Brave New World. Everyone is grown from, you know, in a test tube.
Yeah.
And some people they just use to process power or, like, to process computing programs, right? That are called nulls. They're just, like, zombies.
Right.
And he's the son of a guy who went broke and got his mind deleted so they could use it for processing power. And he gets put in this factory, like, sorting computer parts, but they're, like, indoctrinated. They're, like, sedated, and they don't know anything but to, like, sort parts on a conveyor belt. Mm-hmm. And they're, like, not happy or not sad. They're just, like, zombies.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets rescued by this rebellion.
Right.
And So he becomes a human, even though he like isn't one at the start. So we don't get any of that out of the old man.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I agree with you, but his actual identity is pretty interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's what makes him recognize in the sort of, what do you call it, the crux of the story, when this zombie walks out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And ends up saving his life, like, incidentally.
Yeah.
And then he has this light bulb go on that, like, oh, even the humans that we made just to be, like, slaves for processing power are actually still humans.
Right.
So.
Yeah, yeah. One thing I did like was the descriptions of, like, the terraforming weapons.
Yeah. That was pretty cool.
Do you know where that is? Maybe you could read a little bit of that.
So they use this terraforming weapon that...
Discontinuity
projector. And it...
it's a cool name.
It basically starts to switch time around. So here's a paragraph. So when it first starts to work, it starts to, like, throw all the Earth around and, like, move everything around and, like, tear people apart. It's like some sort of hurricane. So the first part of it is, dervishes of fire stalked the chaos, melting into each other, whirlpooling. Occasionally, a tactical nuclear explosion would punch a hole in the night, a brief intense flare that would be swallowed up like a candle in a murky snowstorm. Once attack detonation coincided with the upthrusting of a rubble mountain with an effect like that of a firecracker exploding inside a swinging sack of grain. Okay? And then it gets crazier. Everything began to flicker, random swatches of savanna land shimmering and blurring, phasing in and out of focus in a jerky, mismatched manner. That film strip run through a spastic projector. At first we thought it must be heat eddies caused by the fires, but then the flickering increased drastically in frequency and tempo, speeding up until it was impossible to keep anything in focus, even for a second, turning the wide veld into a mad kaleidoscope of writhing, interchanging shapes and color patterns from one horizon to the other. It was impossible to watch it for long. It hurt the eyes and filled us with an oily, inexplicable panic that we were never able to verbalize. We looked away, filled with musty surgings of vague fear. So then he talks about how it's like shifting time around.
Yeah.
And it causes even more damage. And the crazy part about this is that it kills 8 billion people.
Oh, yeah.
This battle kills 8 billion people.
That's more people than live on
Earth right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And... That was sort of going back to Delaney, like the single sentence thing, where it's like, well, yeah, if you had an intergalactic war and it's operating on the same scale as our past wars, that's what would happen. Mm-hmm. And it's like, there's way more than 8 billion people on the planet, but that doesn't like make it any less fucking insane. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like the numbers are so big, you can't put them into comprehension.
Right.
And he talks about the officers that have like, built this operation, all commit suicide after this because they feel so guilty. So I'll say one last thing before we finish up. What I liked about the story the most, or the two things I liked the most, and you can see if you caught both of these or disagree. One was, so it ends unhappily, where these rebels defeat the Combine, and they get what they want. But in the beginning, he tells them, the narrator says that their society is still like equally controlled. Like even though they win the war, nothing changes. They still live in this dystopian environment. I'll see if I can find that spot. And it's also sort of implied that people are still born in test tubes, that there isn't like this return to some sort of more simpler time or like less technologically controlled time. Fewer test tubes, fewer brain washings. There's none of that.
Gotta keep that brain nice and clean.
Yeah, so that's interesting because it reflects the real world. Oftentimes, we have wars and it's like nothing is better afterwards. It's just like a bunch of people died and now we're friends with that country again.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes it's like, yeah, it's probably for the best that Imperial Japan doesn't exist anymore, Nazis or other people. But there's lots of other wars throughout history where like, that didn't change anything. Mm-hmm. You know? Like, it was totally pointless. So I like that part because I like dark stuff. Mm. The other part that was really impressive is that he builds this entire universe about, you know, sort of endless life by uploading your brain into computers and using zombies, disembodied humans as processing power. There's all these details, but he just keeps it in a short story. Mm. He doesn't put it into like a novel. And as somebody who writes longer form stuff and has a hard time not exploring every part of a universe, it's really impressive because he just leaves it implied. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this implication of this, all these characters have these long detailed lives, and there's all this fantastic technology that he doesn't explain. He doesn't even like define it. There's like phase shields and force fields and like scatter shields and all this stuff, and you just kind of go with it. He doesn't explain how it works, and I just thought that was really impressive. It was really cool.
Hmm.
And it's probably like he was a short story writer. He didn't have the time to put all that in there, but the restraint is really admirable to me.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I like this. This is him summarizing everything he's talked about in the story.
Okay, so this is near the end.
Yeah, I learned two things. That everybody is human, including the nulls, I guess, is the implication. And that the universe doesn't care one way or the other. Only people do. The universe just doesn't give a damn. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that a relief? It isn't out to get you, and it isn't going to help you either. You're on your own. We all are, and we all have to answer to ourselves. We make our own heavens and hells. We can't pass the buck any further. How much easier when we could blame our guilt or goodness on God.
Which also sort of lines up with the embedded metaphor in the story, which is this is kind of a riff off of Vietnam. It's also kind of a riff off the American Revolutionary War, where they're like these hit-and-run rebels that are playing by their own rules, and they use ancient technologies to defeat their highly advanced opponents. It's sort of a dead ringer for the Viet Cong and that whole conflict. But at the same time, he's sort of like, yeah, but there wasn't any point. Like, don't try to read too much into this. The Vietnam War didn't have any larger point. And it's hard not to, because you'd be like, well, Vietnam isn't occupied by the U.S. anymore. So it did have a larger point. It wasn't the one that necessarily the U.S. at the time wanted. But it did. And it's like, if you compare that to the Revolutionary War, or the American Revolutionary War, I should say, it's like, yeah, there isn't any point. But then at the other side, you're like, well, there totally is. You know, it's the foundation of this new country and separated from England and all this. But I like that he has that perspective.
Yeah.
It's a rare one in war stories, because a lot of times I think people, they can't get, they've been through so much trauma, they can't accept that there's no point.
Yeah. Totally.
So it's sort of refreshing. I mean, it's nihilistic, it's depressing, but it's also refreshing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we always want to create meaning when there's loss.
Right.
But that's what I like about the story.
Yeah. It does seem like the longer you hold on to, so you go through this, well, you go through this traumatic thing, and you want it to be meaningful, but maybe by giving it meaning, it's like, you end up encouraging other people to experience a similar trauma. I don't know. It seems like there should be a way to give it meaning. Like, I mean, it is meaningful. There should be a way to give it meaning without getting mad at the pacifists or something.
So this reminds me of, and we're, I don't want to tangent too far.
Yeah.
But this reminds me of the book, What It's Like to Go to War by Carl Marlantes. And he talks about the way to prevent mental health issues with soldiers is to have them fight for a certain set of moral values, not for like a political cause, because then you're much less likely to get PTSD or get these other problems,
because it wasn't all for naught.
And sometimes it can be for a bad cause.
So
he makes this comparison of like, you know, if you are a German soldier in World War II and you're fighting for your country, and you're fighting to uphold certain laws that have very, you know, simplistic meanings, or if you're just fighting to try to keep the soldiers under your command alive,
yeah,
you're going to be way messed up, or way less messed up after the war than if you're an ardent Nazi.
Than if you're what?
Than if you're an ardent Nazi. If you're really hardcore about Nazism and you're fighting for these political things.
Yeah.
He then makes a comparison to Vietnam, where he was like, if you go to Vietnam being like, I'm going to not, you know, I'm going to just fight enemy soldiers. I'm not going to try to hurt civilians. I'm going to try to keep the people under my command alive. I'm going to try to do good things.
Yeah.
You're going to be way better off than being like, I'm going to eliminate communism.
Yeah.
So he says political reasons are problematic for motivation for a soldier.
Hmm.
That you have to have something you're fighting for, right? Hmm. But political motivations can be problematic.
Interesting.
So maybe that's something that Dozois was getting at. Maybe he knew veterans that tried to like give that idea to him.
Yeah.
You know, because it is sort of a metaphor for Vietnam. So maybe that's part of where he got this, was from Vietnam veterans who were like, yeah, it's way harder to come back sane if you're, you know, if you really believe in the cause.
Yeah.
So.
Well, should we stop there?
That's it. That's it for this week. We'll be back next week. Okay. What are we going to talk about next week?
We have to figure that out, huh?
I just started reading The World Inside by Robert Silverberg. Okay. It's a dystopian story about when humanity has, 200 billion people on the planet that live in massive high-rises that are, like, 5 stories tall.
Oh, so were you? Oh, maybe you were telling me. Someone was telling me
about that. Yeah.
Okay.
That's pretty cool. We should also talk about Time Considered as a Helix of Semi-Precious Stones.
Oh, yeah.
If you haven't started reading, we do more Delaney. We should start Dahlgren, too.
That sounds good.
So we got some new stuff coming up for next week.
Cool.
We're going to discuss. All right.
Thanks, Leonard.
Yeah, thanks, Benny.
Bye.